let's notice some of the things I'm sure you have, which Sanballat and the others sought to do to try to intimidate Nehemiah and to eliminate his usefulness as a leader, because clearly Nehemiah was the key factor in getting this job done. It hadn't made any progress without him, but in the space of just a few weeks, 52 days, as you can see in verse 15 of chapter 6, the wall had been completed with him. So Nehemiah was clearly a key element in the success of the project. No wonder that Sanballat and the others wanted to get at him. Let's notice some of the ways they tried to do that. First of all, there was this strategy of enticement that we read about in verses 1 to 4. Come, let's meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me, he says. It's not clear, I think, what precisely that harm that they planned was. It's possible it was assassination. Maybe they thought they could get away with murdering Nehemiah. So that possibly would have been a rather politically dangerous thing for them to do, because he was officially a civil servant in the service of the emperor. So I think it's rather more likely that it was harm in the form of compromise. They were trying, I think, to negotiate Nehemiah. Now they'd realized they'd lost the battle to stop the rebuilding, into some kind of compromise situation, some kind of diplomatic surrender. Let's come to some mutually acceptable arrangement, Nehemiah. We governors must stick together. That sort of thing. And you see how persistent they were in this. They sent him letters not just once, but four times, trying to get him into this kind of compromising relationship with them. And when that doesn't work, you notice, they use more intimidatory tactics, a kind of political blackmail, sending the same invitation to come and get negotiating, but this time accompanied with this unsealed letter accusing Nehemiah of sedition and all kinds of slander like that. I suppose in those days, sending an open letter in this way was a bit like leaking something to the press. You know, hard to imagine how many people had opened the envelope and read the contents before it got to Nehemiah. It was being blabbed about all over. I want to hear what they're saying, you know. And of course it could be not immensely damaging, couldn't it? As far as Nehemiah was concerned, this letter was the equivalent of a press leak that Neil Kinnock had secret links with the IRA, or that Maggie Thatcher was in league with the National Front, or something like that. The hot-headed would be influenced by it and become rash. Maybe they think it'd be a good idea to rebel against the Persians. And the cautious, they'll become unsettled by it and think to themselves, "Oh, I wonder if this Nehemiah is really such a sound chap as he thought he was." Always round, you see, it could damage his credibility. So it was a blatant attempt to destroy Nehemiah's public reputation, to blackmail him into getting into a situation of compromise and diplomatic exchange with these enemies that he so much wanted to keep out of Jerusalem's affairs. And then when that fails, they try trickery. Simple deceit, verse 10. He goes to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, who was shut in at his home. Presumably he'd read some message that this man wasn't well or something like that. And he says, "Let's meet in the house of God inside the temple. Let us close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night they're coming to kill you." It's clear from the following verse that this fellow Shemaiah was a prophet, and that he'd been hired by the enemy to seduce Nehemiah into an act either of simple cowardice or perhaps of profanity. Anyway, into doing something that could be used to discredit him. "Now, I've got a word from the Lord. Your life's in danger. You must meet us in this secret hideout, this secret conspiracy." And then, of course, people would hear that Nehemiah had been plotting with some people in secret, and this would add fuel to the slanders that were being spread about him. And on top of the intimidation and the enticements and the blackmail and the trickery, there seems to have been a whole weight of psychological pressure put on him in more general ways, doesn't there? In verse 14, he talks about the prophetess, Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who've been trying to intimidate me. These are the preachers of the community. And it seems that some of them had been got at and were using their pulpits to criticize Nehemiah. And there was another sort of fifth column too, wasn't there, that we read about in verses 17 to 19. Nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under oath to him. There's always jealousy in these sort of situations. The nobles, remember, had no cause to be grateful to Nehemiah. He'd taken a very firm line with them over the exploitation of labor and their financial transactions, their abuse of their power and their money. I have little doubt that Nehemiah was not popular in their books. And in any case, some of them were related to these enemy forces. They'd intermarried with them. As we shall find later on, that has been a problem in the Jewish community. And some of these nobles were the worst offenders in that regard. So that there was all kinds, you see, of subtle pressure being put on Nehemiah, giving the enemy a good name, spying simultaneously, all kinds of fifth column activities of that sort going on under the cover of apparently supporting him. Well, all these tactics, I suppose, have their equivalents, don't they, in the life of any leader. The flattering enticements of those who would encourage us to make alliances with those we really should steer well clear of. Won't you come and speak at this conference? Won't you join this fraternal? All sorts of invitations like that come to a leader that can be extremely compromising. And sometimes it can be more intimidatory too, can't it? The more direct slanders of those who would injure our good name, write letters to magazines, put false interpretations on what we're doing. Trickery too. Trap us into a compromising situation through some apparently credible source, somebody that we would otherwise have trusted. I felt the Lord telling me to tell you to do this, Roy. Like Peter, even, remember, who was used by the devil to seduce Jesus. And then there's the pressure, isn't there? You do realize, don't you, that so-and-so is a relative of so-and-so. Now, you don't really want to offend them, do you? You know what so-and-so said in his sermon about you the other day, don't you? So it goes on. But I want you to notice how Nehemiah reacts to all these tactics to try to undermine him, discredit him. First of all, notice his clear insight into his enemy's motives in verse 2. They were scheming to harm me. He's under no illusions about Sanballat and that crowd. They might have been coming to him all softly, softly, trying to pretend that they had his best interests in, at heart now. But Nehemiah was not so stupid, not so gullible. He saw right through them. They want to discredit me. They want to harm me. That's what their interest is, to spoil the work I'm doing. I'm afraid one of the problems that some Christian leaders have is that they are all too gullible. Too much a soft touch to the con man. Notice, too, his refusal to be distracted from the task in verse 3. I'm carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? He says. Remember, we sang that song from Pilgrim's Progress. And of course, there are many cases, examples, aren't there, in that story of how Christian got himself in all kinds of trouble because he wouldn't stick to the path. He would go wandering off doing other things. He would allow himself to be distracted. It is an enemy tactic to distract the leader from the central job he ought to be getting on with, doing other things, because people encourage him to do them. Shouldn't you be involved in this? Shouldn't you be involved in that? Another thing which was a great shield and armor to Nehemiah was his clear conscience before God and men. Verse 8. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making that out of your head. I do like that. He just wouldn't be intimidated. He wasn't going to allow these silly slanders to blackmail him. Because it really is very difficult to blackmail a person of real integrity. Everybody knew Nehemiah. Everybody knew what he stood for. Everybody knew what he'd done. It was going to be extraordinarily difficult to knock a hole in this man's reputation. Because he was a man of such absolute integrity. When a leader has that, he really has a great strength, doesn't he? And notice, too, the role of private prayer in his life. In verse 9, they were trying to frighten us, but I pray, now strengthen my hand. I want you to notice the first person singular there. This is a very personal prayer. This is Nehemiah on his own, feeling perhaps that there are not many people he can trust around him. Please, God, strengthen my hand. Here's a man who prays on his own. We would understand a lot more of the courage of this man if we knew more of the kind of devotional life he had. So important for a leader not to lose touch with God personally. And of course, he shows great spiritual discernment, doesn't he? In verses 11 and 13. I realized God hadn't sent this chap, Shemaiah, but he'd prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. It's very subtle when spiritual sources are used to try to influence you. People who have a reputation for the word of God. Very, very difficult to resist. But there is such a thing as false prophecy. Every Christian has to be alert to it, and particularly as a leader. He could distinguish this false prophet from the true. No more vital skill for anybody who wants to make sure the work gets done. And finally, of course, the thing that I want you to notice about Nehemiah is his refusal to become complacent. That comes out very strongly in the early verses of chapter 7, doesn't it? It's not clear in verse 3 whether the gates are not to be opened until the sun is hot or while the sun is hot. There's a slight ambiguity there. It could be, the point could be that siesta time is a dangerous time rather than a safe time. But whatever the precise instruction that Nehemiah was giving to the gatekeepers in that verse, it's clear that he would not allow them to let up on vigilance. That would have been very easy, having survived so long with no walls. Now the wall was built and the gates were up. It would have been very easy to relax. The job's done. We're safe. But no, Nehemiah was never going to become complacent. He knew you could win a battle and lose the campaign. The struggle was a continual one, so he maintains vigilance. What they call on Star Trek, red alert, isn't it? You keep your eyes about you. And he makes sure that he has trusted people around him. Hanani and Hananiah. Make sure that the people who have responsibility for the defense of the citadel are men he can trust, men he can rely on. Well, I'm sure you haven't found it difficult as you've learned some of those lessons, I'm sure, in your own study, to think of applications to today. We at Eden here have seen quite a lot of progress, haven't we, in the last 5 years or so since we moved into this new building. Seen our church grow, we've seen new opportunities, seen numerical increase, all kinds of ways. We've seen the walls going up. Well, maybe the lesson of this final section of our study in Nehemiah is that the more success we have, the more important it is to pray for our leaders. Because the enemy's strategy, as success is gained within the people of God, is to attack the leaders. And make no mistake about it, the leaders are vital. If leadership had not been given to the people of God, the wall wouldn't have been built. It was because Nehemiah came that the wall started. If the plans against Nehemiah had been successful, the wall would have fallen down again without any doubt. It would have fallen into disrepair. There would have been enemy invasions of all sorts. It was vital that Nehemiah was there. So, when the people of God are having success, pray for your leaders. The devil will be tempting them to compromise. He'll be intimidating them by misrepresentation and slander. He'll be trying to trick them with spiritual-sounding arguments. He'll be trying to pressurize them through influential people and contacts. So pray for their spiritual insight. Pray for their single-minded commitment to the task. Pray for their integrity, that their hearts may be kept right. Pray for their personal devotional life. Pray that they may not surrender to complacency, as the walls do seem to get built and the gates are put in place. A great work, said General Booth, is first of all impossible, then it's difficult, then it's done. Well, in one sense, the work was completed in 52 days. The war was completed. When all our enemies heard about this, they lost their self-confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. Yet, of course, it was only a phase, only a stage, wasn't it, in the progress of God's people. There was much more work to be done. And it's worth remembering that Nehemiah was just one leader in a long succession of leaders that God had given to his people to bring them through the time of exile and up to the coming of their Messiah. But we should be remembering. Let's spend a while in prayer together now, if we may. I hope you have thought of issues that you'd like to be praying for, prayers perhaps you'd specifically like to be praying for Christian leaders you know. We'll spend a time in open prayer now when you can mention some of those matters that are on your heart.